The headlines: Iran's President Hassan Rouhani says he expects the next U.S. administration to compensate Tehran for the wrong policies pursued by Donald Trump over the past 4 years. Russia registers a record 507 additional deaths and over 23,000 new infections from coronavirus. And clashes erupt between police and people in the French city of Bordeaux in a protest against a new security law that bans filming police officers. Hello and welcome, everybody. Here in the Iranian capital, Tehran, this is the World News. Our top story for this half-hour: Iran's President Hassan Rouhani says he expects the next U.S. administration to compensate his country for the wrong policies pursued by Donald Trump over the past 4 years. Rouhani said President Donald Trump's failure to win a second term was a result of his wrong policies. The Iranian president says those policies included issues such as the coronavirus pandemic and racism. Rouhani said Trump's foreign policies also contributed to his defeat in the November 3rd election. The Iranian president said his country's policies are based on reciprocal respect and commitment. He said if the next U.S. administration respects this, the way would be clear to return to conditions prior to January 2017. That's when Trump took office. Political commentator John Stepping believes that the U.S. approach toward Iran will not change in the long term.
I think that Rouhani's right that Biden is going to reengage on the JCPOA in some fashion or other. He may back off the sanctions, but U.S. foreign policy by and large doesn't change. Given that a lot of European allies want the U.S. to reengage with Iran, they want to be able to do business with Iran. There's going to be a huge incentive for Biden to bend in ways that Pompeo and Trump didn't. But that's probably short-term thinking. Long-term, not much is really going to change, and Iran will continue to be stigmatized and unfairly singled out because Western foreign policy needs a villain, and right now that villain is Iran.
Tehran has slammed the European signatories to the 2015 Iran nuclear deal, namely the UK, France, and Germany, for taking a negative stance over the country's missile program. The trio has long been accused by the Islamic Republic of failing to abide by their commitments under the deal.
The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has lashed out at Britain, France, and Germany for their stance on Tehran's missile program. Speaking in a meeting with the heads of the country's three branches of the government, Ayatollah Khamenei warned the Iranian officials that the three European countries cannot be trusted. The leader also slammed these countries for complicity with the United States in putting the Iranian nation under the pressure of sanctions. Ayatollah Khamenei said the issue of sanctions is a bitter reality and a crime committed by the U.S. and its European partners against the Iranian nation. He also noted that this crime is not new and has been committed against the Iranians for years, but it has intensified over the past 3 years. Ayatollah Khamenei urged people to continue their resistance against such measures. Iran's leader remarks came a day after top French, British, and German diplomats met in Berlin to discuss a joint approach with the incoming administration of U.S. President-elect Joe Biden on reviving the Iranian nuclear deal. The three European countries also issued a joint condemnation of what they called Iran's latest breaches, including the use of more advanced centrifuges. This as Tehran has itself been critical of the European signatories to the nuclear deal for not abiding by their obligations following the unilateral U.S. withdrawal from the agreement in May 2018. Tehran says the European countries have failed to make up for Washington's reimposition of sanctions. Many believe the European governments lack the political will to counter U.S. measures against the 2015 nuclear agreement.
Regardless of the good cop, bad cop, Jekyll and Hyde game, which is what we've seen between Washington and EU, I think our European colleagues, there's a lack of political will when it comes to Iran. They've been engaging when it comes to the Iranian nuclear accord. In practice, we have been witnessing a lack of political will, like I said, as well as the economic leverage that the Europeans seem to not have over Washington.
The Islamic Republic has also criticized the European party's inaction on U.S. measures following its withdrawal while Tehran remained committed to the pact. Tehran argues that its retaliatory measures are in accordance with the terms of the JCPOA. To show its goodwill, Iran has also said it will undo its commitment rollbacks only if the European signatories honor their commitments. Iran says the E3 needs to restore balance to the landmark accord by working to lift sanctions against Tehran. What has left the Iran nuclear deal in jeopardy is indisputably the U.S. pullout in the first place and lack of valor on the part of the Europeans not to get in line with U.S. hostile approaches toward Tehran. However, one should be skeptical to see if the coming U.S. administration can bring anything tangible to save the agreement.
And leading a diplomatic delegation, Iran's foreign ministry spokesman has visited Kabul to meet with top Afghan officials. Our correspondent Amin Alami reports from Kabul.
In an official visit to Afghanistan, Iran's foreign ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh is seeking to boost ties between Kabul and Tehran via expanding mutual cooperation, mainly in terms of peace and security.
Security of Afghanistan is our high priority. We think that the security of two nations, Iran and Afghanistan, are very much connected to each other. So we think that through collaboration, through cooperation, we have to be able to secure a stable situation in Afghanistan.
The visit of Iran's foreign ministry spokesman comes as many here believe Afghanistan is entering a new phase, and that is why players like Iran are struggling to keep their role in the country's peace and security.
Afghanistan is entering a new phase, and all regional players have developed new plans in line with their own interests. For instance, Daesh is replacing the Taliban in Afghanistan. The visit of Iran's foreign ministry spokesman to Kabul proves Iran's effort to expand its role in Afghanistan's security.
The visit of Iran's delegation comes as Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan visited Kabul last week.
The recent political trips of Afghanistan's eastern and western neighbors to Kabul are a proof of importance of the country to them. That is especially at a time when insecurity is on the rise and negotiations are underway between the Afghan government and the Taliban to bring a lasting peace to the war-torn nation. Sayed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Yemen's popular Ansar forces hit back hard to very deep inside Saudi Arabia this week. Yemen's latest reprisal attack has once again reminded the oil-rich kingdom that it cannot hit and run. Yemen's capabilities to respond to the Saudi-led war have been improving fast.
A successful hit deep inside Saudi Arabia. Yemen's Ansar fighters carried out a retaliatory missile strike on an oil facility in the Saudi port city of Jeddah on Monday. The Yemeni army says a new winged missile called the Quds 2 was used in the operation against the distribution station operated by Saudi Aramco. Yemen's military spokesman Yahya Sari said it was another response to the Saudi-led aggression against Yemen. The military spokesman warned Saudis and foreign companies operating in the kingdom to stay away from vital installations, as he pledged that Yemeni fighters will keep up such retaliatory operations. The new Quds 2 cruise missile must have flown over 400 miles to reach its target. The latest missile strike once again underscores Ansarullah's fast improving capabilities to hit Saudi targets with high precision.
This strike on Aramco's site should certainly let the Saudi kingdom know that this is not a war it can win. It has attempted for years to defeat the Yemeni people and has not succeeded, and they're only getting stronger.
Ansarullah's arsenal of new weapons, including projectiles and drones, has become a major headache for the Saudis nearly 6 years after they began the war to defeat the popular forces. The Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, the de facto ruler of the kingdom and the architect of the war, has been under pressure to find a way to end the failing, protracted military campaign. None of the strategic goals of the invasion have been fulfilled after all these years. But bin Salman's close ties with the U.S. President Donald Trump, mainly based on huge American arms sales, have allowed him to keep the war going. Will the Saudi prince take the increasing power of Yemeni forces seriously and change direction?
Well, the Yemeni army says its Quds 2 missile with improved range and precision became operational recently. The ground-launched projectile is the latest addition to Yemen's expanding arsenal of domestically manufactured weapons. The Yemenis say they have the means to retaliate effectively if the Saudis decide to escalate their military offensive. The Yemeni missile strike came soon after a meeting between Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman and U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. The United States under President Donald Trump has been deeply involved in the brutal war against Yemen, but will America's stance change in any way?
The Saudi-led war in Yemen began in March 2015. It will be the sixth anniversary of the war in just a few months. The war in Yemen has been described by many as a forgotten war. the onslaught has been rarely covered by mainstream media. Even when Saudi airstrikes hit markets, weddings, schools, or hospitals, killing large numbers of civilians, the war got little attention in Western news channels. The situation has long been the world's worst humanitarian disaster. As the Yemenis suffered, the business-minded president of the United States took the opportunity to seal massive arms deals with the Saudis. The kingdom has been free to buy anything from America, from fighter jets to command and control system and advanced battle tanks and warships. The U.S. is a partner in this aggression. The U.S. military support for the Saudis and their Emirati allies also includes mid-air refueling, providing intelligence and logistics. The incumbent U.S. president will probably leave the White House soon. How will his successor Joe Biden act on Yemen? Saudi Arabia has a very powerful lobby in Washington, and the kingdom's petrodollars have proven irresistible to American politicians and decision-makers for many decades.
It's unlikely there'll be any change. The U.S. is always happy to foment and encourage a disruption and disorder and chaos anywhere in the Middle East. And because Saudi Arabia is such a large buyer of U.S. weaponry, the United States government under Biden or Trump or anybody else will not want to see those profits diminish.
Biden faces tough choices over Yemen and his ties with the regime of Saudi Arabia, as he will probably need to make very important decisions soon.
Elsewhere, the coronavirus pandemic keeps taking its toll on European countries as the number of fatalities and infections continue to rise. Russia on Wednesday reported a record 507 deaths in 24 hours. That takes Russia's overall fatalities to more than 37,500. The country's total cases are more than 2.1 million. Also on Wednesday, Germany registered a record 410 new deaths from the virus. That brings the country's total fatalities to nearly 15,000 out of more than 960,000 cases. Germany is expected to extend a partial lockdown introduced in early November. European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen has warned against relaxing lockdown measures too quickly. She says there is a risk of a third wave of infections. Clashes have broken out between police and protesters in the French city of Bordeaux. The demonstrators set fire to trash cans, smashed store windows, and tagged walls. The protest was the latest in nationwide demonstrations against a new security law. The proposed legislation would criminalize the dissemination of images of police officers unless their faces are blurred. Those found guilty would be imprisoned or receive fines. Activists have denounced the law as a violation of press freedom. The excessive use of force by French police has come under scrutiny. That came after a series of incidents were captured on video and shared on social media platforms. The head of the European Commission says any post-Brexit trade deal with Britain must not affect the European Union's single market. Ursula von der Leyen said the EU is ready to reach an agreement with Britain. However, she stressed that the bloc will not compromise on the integrity of its market. Von der Leyen urged London to accept what she called fair trade rules. The EU's chief executive also said the bloc is prepared for a no-deal situation after the year-end deadline. Britain withdrew from the EU in January and is now in a transition period. The two sides are at loggerheads over the future of their trade ties as some issues remain unresolved. Human rights abuses in the European Union are on the rise. According to members of the European Parliament, legislators from across the 27-nation bloc claim COVID-19 is exacerbating the problem. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
A debate on fundamental rights in the EU has just concluded in the European Parliament. COVID-19 lockdowns and reduced access to services due to the pandemic have apparently made the elderly more vulnerable, and other groups too.
Women, children in poverty, and people with disabilities.
The 27-nation bloc's asylum system was castigated during the debate.
We have migrants left to rot and fester in camps, while boats of pregnant women and children are pushed out to sea by state forces in Greece. We have migrants raped with the branches of trees by state forces in Croatia. We have Muslims hounded in France.
It's claimed the EU's attitude towards refugees is facilitating abuses both within the bloc and in neighbouring countries.
Greece, Turkey, Poland, Belarus, Spain, Morocco, Hungary, Serbia. And in some countries, Croatia, they even face torture, humiliation, and sexual abuse.
Governments in EU nations, such as Czech Republic and Hungary, are fueling Islamophobia by the way they are dealing with the refugee crisis, according to experts.
They've sought to interpret that crisis as a one of Muslim invasion. And government narratives, when they're deployed in that way, can be very strong.
Other fundamental rights abuses in the EU are also being highlighted. Spanish authorities are criticised for imprisoning activists in Catalonia.
We spend all our time asking Hungary and Poland to act like genuine democratic states, but we don't do anything on Spain. Without civil and political rights, the European project is done for.
Some lawmakers accuse the EU of hypocrisy in terms of how it tries to export its values.
Let's just take one example, cozying up to Israel and Saudi Arabia, which have appalling human rights records, while at the same time imposing really tough sanctions against countries such as Russia and Iran. Jerome Hughes, the European Parliament, Brussels.
U.S. media say President Donald Trump plans to pardon his former national security advisor who admitted lying to the FBI over his Russian contacts. Trump reportedly plans to include Michael Flynn in a series of pardons he will issue during his last days of presidency. Flynn's secret contacts with the Russian ambassador to Washington was a key part of a probe into Russia's alleged meddling in the 2016 U.S. presidential election. Flynn pleaded guilty in 2017 to lying to the FBI about those contacts. He was fired by Trump less than a month into his administration. In May this year, the Justice Department withdrew its case against Flynn. It said his alleged lies to the FBI were not significant. The projected winner of the 2020 U.S. presidential election has formally introduced his nominations for high-profile cabinet positions as the transition of power appears to be gaining momentum.
Today, I'm pleased to announce nominations and staff for critical foreign policy and national security positions in my administration. It's a team that will keep our country and our people safe and secure. And it's a team that reflects the fact that America is back, ready to lead the world, not retreat from it, once again sit at the head of the table, ready to confront our adversaries and not reject our allies.
In an event in Delaware, Joe Biden confirmed that Anthony Blinken and John Kerry will be his secretaries of state and climate, respectively. He also named Alejandro Mayorkas as Secretary of Homeland Security. Moreover, Biden introduced Avril Haines to be the Director of National Intelligence, the first ever woman appointed to that post. The announcements came a day after President Donald Trump authorized his administration to officially begin the transition process. Despite that, Trump has refused to concede and vowed to continue his fight in court. Meanwhile, Pennsylvania and Nevada have certified Biden's win, further dashing Trump's hopes of clinging to power. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on November 3, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference on the occasion of the birthday anniversaries of the Holy Prophet of Islam and Imam Ja'far as-Sadiq, greetings be upon them, and which coincides this year with the National Day of Fighting Against Global Arrogance and Unity Week. Imam's great initiative in naming Unity Week.
As for Unity Week, today, more than ever, the importance of Imam's initiative has become clear. Many officials in Islamic countries did not understand how important the message was. In other words, they tended to ignore it because of their various ulterior motives. However, today we understand how important the message was. The events that have taken place today, the various differences that exist among Islamic countries, and the horrible incidents that have taken place in some regional countries, including in Syria, in Iraq, and at a certain point in time in Libya, in Yemen, and in Afghanistan, help us understand how important the unity of the world of Islam was, and how precious the solidarity of the Islamic Ummah was, as announced and demanded by Imam Khomeini. If that unity had existed, many of these incidents would not have occurred. What exists in the world of Islam today, particularly in a certain part of it in the region, is really disastrous. They undermine the issue of Palestine. They have made the treacherous and despicable move to normalize their relations with the Zionists. All these are the outcomes of lack of unity in the world of Islam.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want or need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
For the sake of appearances and based on corrupt and false motives, such an indecent act was committed, which culminated in the violation of the Palestinian nation's rights at the hands of certain people. Of course, the Palestinian cause cannot end, and they're too small to be able to put an end to this matter. The Palestinian cause will continue to thrive. Palestine will become Palestine, and the Zionist regime will be destroyed. There is no doubt about this. However, they are creating obstacles on the way of this cause within the scope of their capabilities. One of the things that they have done is to establish relations with that murderous and criminal usurper, the Zionist regime.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
On the news line.
A successful hit deep inside Saudi Arabia. Yemen's Ansarullah fighters carried out a retaliatory missile strike on an oil facility in the Saudi port city of Jeddah on Monday. The Yemeni army says a new winged missile called the Quds 2 was used in the operation against the distribution station operated by Saudi Aramco. Yemen's military spokesman Yahya Sari said it was another response to the Saudi-led aggression against Yemen. The military spokesman warned Saudis and foreign companies operating in the kingdom to stay away from vital installations, as he pledged that Yemeni fighters will keep up such retaliatory operations. The new Quds 2 cruise missile must have flown over 400 miles to reach its target. The latest missile strike once again underscores Ansarullah's fast improving capabilities to hit Saudi targets with high precision.
This strike on Aramco's site should certainly let the Saudi kingdom know that this is not a war it can win. It has attempted for years to defeat the Yemeni people and has not succeeded, and they're only getting stronger.
Ansarullah's arsenal of new weapons, including projectiles and drones, has become a major headache for the Saudis nearly 6 years after they began the war to defeat the popular forces. The Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, the de facto ruler of the kingdom and the architect of the war, has been under pressure to find a way to end the failing, protracted military campaign. None of the strategic goals of the invasion have been fulfilled after all these years. But bin Salman's close ties with the U.S. President Donald Trump, mainly based on huge American arms sales, have allowed him to keep the war going. Will the Saudi prince take the increasing power of Yemeni forces seriously and change direction? The Saudi-led war in Yemen began in March 2015. It will be the sixth anniversary of the war in just a few months. The war in Yemen has been described by many as a forgotten war. The onslaught has been rarely covered by mainstream media. Even when Saudi airstrikes hit markets, weddings, schools, or hospitals, killing large numbers of civilians, the war got little attention in Western news channels. The situation has long been the world's worst humanitarian disaster. As the Yemenis suffered, the business-minded president of the United States took the opportunity to seal massive arms deals with the Saudis. The kingdom has been free to buy anything from America, from fighter jets to command and control system and advanced battle tanks and warships. The U.S. is a partner in this aggression. The U.S. military support for the Saudis and their Emirati allies also includes mid-air refueling, providing intelligence and logistics. The incumbent U.S. president will probably leave the White House soon. How will his successor Joe Biden act on Yemen? Saudi Arabia has a very powerful lobby in Washington, and the kingdom's petrodollars have proven irresistible to American politicians and decision-makers for many decades.
It's unlikely there'll be any change. The U.S. is always happy to foment and encourage a disruption and disorder and chaos anywhere in the Middle East. And because Saudi Arabia is such a large buyer of U.S. weaponry, the United States government under Biden or Trump or anybody else will not want to see those profits diminish.
Biden faces tough choices over Yemen and his ties with the regime of Saudi Arabia, as he will probably need to make very important decisions soon.
The naval fleet of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guard Corps has recently received a new domestically built ocean-going warship capable of carrying aircraft, drones, and missile defense systems. The heavyweight multi-purpose vessel, which has been designed for long sea journeys, joined the IRGC's Navy during a ceremony on Thursday. The 4,000-ton warship, which is 150 meters long and 22 meters wide, can carry drones, helicopters, and operational vessels, as well as missile, air defense, and radar systems. It is named Shahid Rudaki Warship after martyred IRGC Navy Commander Abdullah Rudaki. The vessel is equipped with three-dimensional phased array radars, surface-to-surface and surface-to-air missiles, advanced communication systems for electronic warfare, and a Khordad 3 air defense system, all of which are designed and put into operation by Iranian experts.
The main issue for the armed forces is to be strong enough to defend the country and to retaliate any possible attack against Iran. So that is part of that. And since we have the Persian Gulf and actually the Caspian Sea and south and north of Iran, it has been very important to have a good and powerful navy.
Rear Admiral Alireza Tangsiri, commander of Iran's IRGC Navy, said the vessel can carry out combat, logistical, and intelligence-gathering missions in the ocean aimed at establishing stable security in maritime transportation lines and providing assistance to the commercial and fishing fleets belonging to the Islamic Republic and regional countries. U.S. President Donald Trump's new acting defense secretary, Christopher Miller, said last week that Washington will be cutting the number of its deployed troops to Afghanistan and Iraq to 5,000 from 7,500 forces that are currently present there. Just days later, however, the U.S. Central Command said in a statement that two B-52 bombers were deployed to West Asia on short notice to deter what it called potential aggression and reassure U.S. partners and allies in the region. That comes after the New York Times said in a report that Trump had asked his close allies what options were available to take action against Iran's main nuclear site at Natanz. The report adds that the advisors warned the president that a military action could spark a broader conflict in the region.
There have been times that Iran and the United States have been much closer to a war between themselves. So it's not a tough situation right now. It's not the tension is high to some extent, but it's not that high that we would be worried about any possible war. But the United States know that it's not capable of attacking Iran and doing a war, because we have seen for 20 years the situation in Afghanistan and in Iraq, and the United States was not capable of fighting against those countries completely, and we were introduced to endless wars because of those two countries. So let alone the Iran, which is actually much more powerful and much bigger than those countries.
Some experts are now questioning how such an attack would help Donald Trump while the United States is dealing with political uncertainty over who will control the White House for the next 4 years following a contested election. Donald Trump announced the United States' withdrawal from the Iran nuclear deal in 2018 and launched his so-called maximum pressure campaign against Tehran by unilaterally reimposing sanctions on the country. His stance on Iran has been repeatedly criticized internationally, including even by the closest U.S. allies. But Tehran has warned that any aggression by the U.S. against Iran, be it Trump's attempt to distract the American public in the aftermath of the November 3rd election, or an excuse to stay in power, will certainly be met with a crushing response.
Russia says the United States has deceived Moscow, and the international community after it conducted an advanced intercontinental missile interception test. Russia's foreign ministry says the exercise used technology that is part of the Aegis Ashore missile defense system, which the Pentagon had assured the Kremlin was not aimed at Russia's long-range capabilities. A Russian foreign ministry spokesperson has described the development as quote-unquote a new confirmation of the dangerous and destabilizing character of Washington's anti-ballistic missile strategy and, quote, obvious anti-Russian orientation. Maria Zakharova says the test proved the falsity of American statements, saying, quote, for many years, America assured us that the interception of Russian ICBMs by American standard systems, including this modification, is technically impossible. There are fears the test risks paving the way for Russia testing similar technologies against America's intercontinental ballistic missiles. Moscow has already stated that it reserves the right to take the necessary response measure. On Monday, the U.S. military used the new advanced technology to fire, for the first time, a missile from a warship which downed an ICBM. Previously, the U.S. had promoted the weapon system as being limited against short and intermediate range missile threats. Russia says this is direct evidence and a concrete example of how Washington manipulated public opinion of its country, lied to its international partners, and justified its actions in the international arena with far-fetched pretexts. following the collapse of the INF and before the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty. The only remaining U.S.-Russian nuclear arms control agreement, New START, is also, as things stand, set to expire early next year. Moscow says it hasn't closed the door on negotiations to extend the agreement, formerly known as the New Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty. The projected U.S. presidential election winner, Joe Biden, has previously said he will explore the treaty's extension without conditions. However, bilateral relations between the two countries have always been on very shaky grounds. Analysts say the latest American missile test will only escalate military tensions. Amid Russia's worsening relations with NATO, it could not have come at a worse time. Questions have been raised as to whether the U.S. may use the system against Russian military interests. The weapon used to down the ICBM, the Standard Missile 3 or SM-3, is part of the Aegis Ballistic Missile Defense System. Moscow has long suspected the system to be a major pathway to a U.S. global missile shield to undermine Russia's military power. The SM-3 missiles have also been deployed close to Russian soil, in Poland and Romania. Moscow says it has repeatedly warned it would take similar measures to ensure national security and maintain a strategic stability. Essentially, that means more sophisticated weapon systems deployed by the adversaries, while suspicions between the U.S. on the one hand and Russia and China on the other spiral out of control.
Bahrain's top diplomat on an official visit to Israel, breaking a long-time taboo. Foreign Minister Abdel Latif al-Zayani landed in Israel on Wednesday. His controversial trip this week marks the first such visit to Israel by any official from the tiny Persian Gulf Kingdom. Al-Zayani's trip coincides with a visit to Israel by America's top diplomat Mike Pompeo. The Bahraini delegation went on to occupy Jerusalem al-Quds. The top Bahraini diplomat sat down for talks with senior Israeli officials, including his counterpart Gabi Ashkenazi and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The U.S. Secretary of State was apparently there to facilitate the controversial rapprochement. Al-Zayani's trip, which has angered the Palestinians, is part of a U.S.-backed push to normalize ties between the two sides.
It is obvious that the Trump administration wants to make sure that the normalization process and the what they used to call the deal of the century will be very crucial and strong before they get away from the power in January. So they are doing marathonian steps so that everything will be on the ground and will be very much clear laid out.
Palestinian groups denounced the trilateral meeting between the U.S., Bahrain, and Israel as a clear attack on the rights of the Palestinian people. The Palestinians want all Arab nations to refrain from establishing ties with Israel until the Israeli occupation is over and a Palestinian state becomes a reality. But as part of a U.S. brokered initiative, Bahrain and its Persian Gulf neighbor, the United Arab Emirates, signed normalization accords with Israel at the White House in mid-September. Sudan has also agreed to normalize ties with Israel as part of a deal that will guarantee much-needed U.S. financial aid. Israel has escalated its violations in the occupied territories over the past years. For instance, it has stepped up settlement construction on occupied lands. The regime has also stepped up demolition of Palestinian homes. So far this year, nearly 700 structures have been razed to the ground across the occupied West Bank, including East Jerusalem al-Quds. The UN says that number is more than the figure in any full year since 2016. Palestinians have widely blamed the worsening situation on policies pursued by the administration of U.S. President Donald Trump. The American president makes no secret of his extremely pro-Israel stance. Trump took the American support for the regime to a whole new level by moves such as recognizing Jerusalem al-Quds as Israel's capital. Palestinian groups now say the U.S.-backed push to normalize ties between several Arab states and Israel is further emboldening the regime. How can Palestinians now trust the U.S. as it loudly brands itself as a mediator between them and Israel? Palestinians have been fighting an uphill battle against occupation for decades. Things are perhaps tougher today as several Arab states are abandoning the cause and normalizing their ties with Israel. Palestinians say these Arab states are stabbing them in the back. Palestinians know all too well that their options are very limited at the moment. As many governments refuse to pressure the Israeli regime, the people of Palestine are hoping popular grassroots campaigns against Israel will one day change things for the better.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, examine yourself every day. Preventing loss and increasing profit in any worldly activity, however big or small, requires continuous monitoring and assessment through inspection. You require measurement and accounting. One can see how careful people are in calculation of their material wealth. Look at these big businessmen, right? How they are so careful about every investment they make and how detailed they are about it? And how sensitive are the Weight Watchers, for instance, about small changes in their weight? Yet, surprisingly, some of them do not look into their human, moral, and spiritual accounts even once during their lifetime. What a terrible negligence it is. A responsible and vigilant Muslim is one who, as the Imam of our time expects, examines his accounts every day without exception. If he has done a good deed, he tries to continue it. And if he has done evil, God forbid, he repents for it. And this is essential. We have to be vigilant and we have to be examining ourselves every day. You know, don't think that, oh, there's still a lot of time left in my life, so, you know, I'll inspect myself and I'll examine myself at a later stage. This is not the right approach. Unless you do it every day, you're not going to move forward spiritually and in terms of your humanistic and moral aspects of your being. Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are discussing the importance of examining yourself every day. There are different types of examinations. One is the physical exam. You know, we need to watch out for our physical existence. But at the same time, something more important is there, and that is examining yourself spiritually, ethically, morally. Imam Qadhim alayhi salam, the seventh Imam, he says, one who does not perform self-examination every day is not from among us. This means he's not from among the believers. This means that he's not from us Ahlul Bayt. He's not related to us. In other words, those who examine themselves every day, they watch for what they have done throughout their days, how their state of their spirituality and their soul is, these are the ones who stand a chance to be those true followers of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wassalam. And then, you know, when you examine yourself, there are two things that you need to keep in mind. One, all those good deeds that you're performing, you have to try your utmost to continue them. Because Satan and Iblis, he's going to try to intervene and stop you from carrying out those good deeds. The second thing you need to keep in mind is, repent for your shortcomings. Turn back to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. We all make mistakes here and there. We have negligences throughout our lives. Let's be real. We have to repent to Allah. We have to turn back to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. These two things will allow you to make your examination of yourself productive. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
European News Bulletin.
Hello everybody, Saeed Bruza here, our top story. We start here in the UK, a legal case to determine whether Shamima Begum, The British woman, who left London as a teenager to join Daesh and marry a member of the Takfiri group, is allowed to return to the UK, has reached the Supreme Court. The government has mounted a legal challenge to block the return of the British-born woman, arguing she poses a terror threat because she most likely had weapons training and has become desensitized to violence. In 2018, then Home Secretary Sajid Javid stripped her of her citizenship in violation of international law. Campaigners believe British-born criminals who commit crimes abroad are still the responsibility of Britain and should be prosecuted on British soil. Begum was discovered 9 months pregnant in a Syrian refugee camp in February 2019 and has since been battling for the right to return to the UK. Charles Shoebridge is a security analyst joining me now to talk about that story. It's good to have you on. A number of fighters have returned to the UK. Why has this case been made an example of?
Yes, you're absolutely right. And of course, that is a key point that I'm sure will be argued by those representing Shamima Begum in the Supreme Court. The fact is, by the briefings of the British government to the media, and off-record briefings by the security services have confirmed again and again that upwards of 50% of people who went off to join Daesh in the Syrian conflict from the United Kingdom have actually returned to the UK and have done so without much in the way of legal impediment. And we're talking about not just wives and children, but we're talking about the actual fighters themselves, which of course Shamima Begum has not claimed to be, and nor has anybody so far claimed that she was actually produced any evidence that she was involved in this, although she may well have been. So you've got a situation where the fighters themselves, the people that carried out so many human rights abuses, war crimes, atrocities in Syria, have been allowed back largely to the United Kingdom, and yet Begum herself has not been. And probably this is because the Home Secretary at the time decided to make an example of her because she was in the media. She perhaps foolishly, from her perspective in retrospect, gave an interview to the Times newspaper where she said that effectively that she in a way justified her position there. And of course that got the anger of the British government and the British media involved, and therefore now it's very difficult for the government to back out of the corner it's painted itself into when it said that she would not be allowed back to the UK, whereas in fact many people in her position have been allowed back.
You used the word foolishly to describe what she did, the interview she did. The government here, the issue of age, the fact that she was very young when she made that decision to go off to Syria, the government here says that her age should not be a factor. Your thoughts?
Yeah, you're right, and I say foolish in respect of the fact she is just about, and even when she gave the interview with the British media, is effectively a child, notwithstanding that the situation she's in. That doesn't excuse what she's done, but it does provide some mitigation. And when you think about the criminal justice system in the UK, and indeed in many other parts of the world, probably most parts of the world, age is a mitigating factor. Also, it's worth noting, I think, that very many other countries, for example, Russia, have long taken back certainly the children of those fighters, that those people that went from their own countries to fight in Syria. And there's an example has been made, for example, by other countries whereby those that actually didn't take part in fighting should be allowed to return. And indeed, there isn't much in the way of example where people who have actually been allowed to return have carried out terrorist attacks. Whereas, of course, many of those that actually were fighters, or some of those that were fighters themselves, when they've returned, as opposed to the wives and children, they have carried out attacks in the past. None of this is to excuse Begum's case. I mean, notwithstanding that she was a child when she went out there, she, I think, knew what she was doing. That was clear in this case. But nonetheless, it is a mitigating factor. And it's also, as your question suggests, it provides a basis of inconsistent treatment. The fact that so many others who actually appear to have carried out appalling atrocities on Syrian soil have been allowed to return.
One very quick question and a very quick answer. If there were to be a hearing, considering this could be politically damaging to the government, do you think there will be an entirely objective hearing?
I think the objective hearing in the courts is quite possible, and we may get an outcome here that is favourable to Begum in this case. And of course, even if the court rules against the government, I think the government in the UK, for domestic political reasons, would be happy with that. It could say, we did our best, and they will blame the courts, which they will then use as further ammunition to reform the courts and perhaps appoint their own judges in due course, because that's the direction of travel that we see in a lot of what the government in the UK is currently doing.
Charles Shoebridge, security analyst. Thank you very much. Moving on. The World Health Organization has hailed the significant breakthroughs in the development of a COVID-19 vaccine with positive news from trials bringing real hopes of an end to national lockdowns around the world. In the UK, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has announced he hoped almost all Britons at high risk from COVID would be vaccinated by April. Turkey's health minister says his country will be purchasing 20 million doses of the vaccine from China's Sinovac biotech after the vaccine showed success by triggering quick immune responses in mid-stage trials. Earlier today, Russian developers of the Sputnik V vaccine revealed their drug is over 95% effective. This just days after Moscow said it would be charging less for its Sputnik V vaccine than some of its Western rivals. Spain's King Felipe VI has begun 10 days of quarantine after coming into contact with a person who tested positive for coronavirus. Palace sources say the 52-year-old king was in close contact with the individual on Sunday, but gave no further details. On Monday, the monarch chaired a scientific meeting in Madrid. Spain has recorded nearly 1.6 million cases and more than 43,000 deaths since the pandemic began, the second highest toll in Western Europe after France. Starting this segment with a story we've been covering that concerns former British Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn. And I'm going to let Ahmed Caballo bring us up to speed. And Ahmed, a demand for an apology yet again.
Yes, so many are describing this as a civil war within the Labour Party. The current leader of the Labour Party, Sir Keir Starmer, seems to want to dismiss and dismantle the legacy of his predecessor, Jeremy Corbyn. And that's because many people see Keir Starmer as the establishment man, somebody that's not going to rock the boat. Or Jeremy Corbyn was very much trying to rock the boat and change the very nature of Britain's foreign policy, of its domestic policy, in the interest of the many rather than the few, was the tagline. Now, Jeremy Corbyn has been accused of anti-Semitism by his detractors, but Corbyn supporters and his allies argued that supporting Palestine does not mean you're anti-Semitic, and the only reason they called him anti-Semitic was to dismantle his program, dismantle his legacy. And now the Labour chief whip is demanding an apology for Jeremy Corbyn for stating that the anti-Semitism case against members, against those who support Corbyn, was politically motivated. Now, Michael Walker has found a interesting tweet. He says, "I've unearthed a clip of another crank claiming the attacks for Jeremy Corbyn were politically motivated. I assume Labour's whip will be demanding a full and swift apology from Keir Starmer."
Well, look, the attacks on Jeremy Corbyn in that election we've just had were terrible, and they came back at us on the door. They vilified him, and they knew what they were doing, and they knew why they were doing it. And they do it to every Labour leader, and they know why they're doing it. Now, we've just lost the election, so we better prepare for the next one. And it's going to happen again, and it needs to change. We need to cut through that.
And it looks like, Ahmed, that those opponents of Jeremy Corbyn won't relent until and unless he is gone.
Yeah, and it's not just about Jeremy Corbyn. Jeremy Corbyn is 71 years of age. It's about anyone that claims to be on the left who wants to then become the Labour leader, and basically discouraging them from doing that, and also making sure that the Labour Party never allows somebody of Jeremy Corbyn's values or principles to lead their party, never to threaten the foreign policy interests such as the Saudi-led war on Yemen, which Britain arms to the teeth the Saudi coalition. We've got a tweet from Chris Williamson, who was one of the victims of this anti-Semitic witch hunt. He says, "No, no, no, 1,000 times no. Jeremy Corbyn has done nothing to apologise for. members of the socialist camp should be giving their unqualified solidarity to him. That's what socialists do. The people that do